There we go. All right. So Ed's ready now. He's got it up on Wikipedia. He's looking a little less red than he was 5 seconds ago.
Not much, though.
Not much. So I'm going to start out with a little, what are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about?
There you go. So we are broadcasting now. This time from the house of La Victoria. No, we're at my house now.
We're at the second home of
that's
La Victoria.
Right, the couch. So this is where we've had some very good podcasts. I think the last one we did from here was The Love Witch, which no one listened to. Thanks for that, guys.
It was a good one.
All-time favorite films, right? You know, and I just not having a lot of luck with that. The reach out to Anna Biller to be like, hey, we could be friends. It was like, no, we can't. And you could listen to this, guys. It'd be a really good podcast. Like, no, it's not. Like, okay. All right, fine. We'll talk about Black Widow, because yes, that's today's topic. So we are tackling. I went to see this in the theater on Sunday. Ed watched this on Disney Plus on what day?
Late last week.
So yeah, we've definitely seen it. We definitely have things to say. So but yeah, otherwise yeah, we're just kicking off today. I am watching Ed a little bit. He's very merry.
I'm
right
a bit
now.
Toasty. So just for the listeners,
he's been making merry with my wife, and that's not a euphemism.
Yeah, that sounds weird.
He's been making merry with my wife all day today.
We had a good hangout at Jason's. We had copious amounts of wine.
You guys had copious amount. I was working
you
today.
You were very responsible.
So I had to be responsible. I was working today. But my wife has been home recovering. If you guys don't know, she had some spinal surgery and she's recovering now. So I wanted to bring Eddie over so the two of them could hang out. Because again, we all met. We were talking a lot of those stories today, weren't we? Yeah. 15 years ago, something like that.
Dude, like, what, 2005?
Yeah, 2005. So
it's like 15, 16? 16
years.
16 years.
Yeah, man.
Long, say that man. Quick, man, but holy shit.
We got old fast, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, be warned, youngins, be warned. That's how quick it goes. So, before we kick off with Black Widow, we'll do first impressions first, just in case you're on the fence. I don't really think you should be on this one. You're either going to want to watch this movie or not, but we will give you first impressions. And we'll talk a little bit about some other stuff we've watched this week after that and then go into detail. But before we do all of that, just please remember what I call the brass tacks. And why I call it that is it's very important for all you listeners to be helping us out. We have a webpage, www.lovevictoriaproductions.com, so the name of the production company.com. That has everything. So that has your Dirty 20, your Carnivale Lore, the unboxing Ed just did. It has all the
Rumble Slam or Rumblestein,
as Becky renamed it. Yeah, for some reason it got renamed to Rumblestein. She just loves German stuff. So, but everything's on there. Ed's old shorts, which are way better, I think, than a lot of other shorts that are out there. Then you guys definitely should be checking out the page. So go there first. They're amazing. They're absolutely amazing. So that's a good way to get a hold of us. We also have social media accounts. So Facebook, you know, you can go to Love Victoria's Productions page. You can go to Jason Shiro or Ed Burgos. Instagram, Jazzy J Shiro or Anano LVP. Twitter, @MouthLoveVictoria or @AnanoskiProd. LinkedIn, we have a company page there that we can be reached at. And then also you have us on TikTok now. We have LBP Film Life, where I usually just kind of give teasers there. So that's a lot of... There will be some kind of weird stuff on there about the forest and things like that and things we're working on. But I also, like, when I went to see Black Widow, I'll record before and after just so you guys know it's coming up. So my whole point with this is, please, you know, share this with your friends, like, subscribe, comment, just interact with all that stuff, man. We put it out there for you because we like interacting with an audience and we like interacting with people who are into filmmaking like we are. So please reach out, have some fun. If you have some suggestion, I know Mitch Bain, who listens to the show, I think he's got two movies he's going to be doing with us now. And he doesn't know I'm going to say, because he's like, oh, we could do this other one. I'm like, why don't you just do both? I'm going to just do both. Come on two shows in a row. Like,
why not?
That's how we are. So if you want to come on the show and you have a good excuse for coming on the show, which doesn't have to be a really big one, then please just email us. You know, just say, hey, can I come on the show and talk about this? Like, absolutely. We are very free form when it comes to that. So brass tacks over, though. Please share, like, and subscribe. Moving on to first impressions for Black Widow. Ed, I always let you go first.
Okay. Oh my God, did I love this film.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And there's a couple of reasons why I think maybe I liked it more than I would have under different circumstances, but there hasn't been a Marvel movie for a long time.
Yeah.
Right?
This was the first one coming back for a while.
Yeah. We've had WandaVision, we've had Falcon and the Winter Soldier, a little bit of Loki and stuff, but there's no substitute for the bombast of like a tentpole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, unfortunately, sometimes there's too many of them going around and everything wants to be a tentpole movie. But it's they're a lot of fun. A lot of, you know, people enjoy watching them. And this one has that. It has the big set pieces, you know, the spectacular special effects. But the story here and the characters and everything about it really spoke to me in a way that I was caught off guard by.
Yes.
That would be my first impression.
No.
I loved it. I didn't expect it. It was a beautiful surprise.
Very good. Yeah, and I think that encompasses everything I would say. The one thing that will get you from this, guys, is it's unexpected. You know, this is, without spoilers, this is a side story. This is not, like, the main MCU drive. It has a lot of MCU elements in it, but the story itself is kind of standalone and separate. So it's another reason, because my wife has gone upstairs so we could do this podcast, but she says, would I like it? And it was like, yes, because it's not, you know, she hasn't watched all the Avenger films, so she wouldn't know all the backstory. You don't really need to know. Yeah. A whole lot about 100%. Anything to watch this. You just have to be ready for a tentpole movie, which brings me to my second point that I think I can add to this. So yeah. I think Ed's put it, you know, really good, but there are considerations with this one. And we'll talk a little bit more about why these were important considerations to some of the producers involved. But you can watch this on Disney Plus for $20, you know, $20 here. And that's the same. That's 20 quid, guys. I love when I get like, what are bucks, man? What are bucks? Like, the same thing as you said when you say quid. It's 20-somethings, okay? In this country, it'll cost you £20, if that makes you feel better. Mm. You can do it that way, or you can go to the theater. I have a Cineworld pass, so that's how I saw it. But I think a ticket would roughly run you 15 quid doing that way. And the theaters are generally empty right now. Now, if you're asking me if you can get over your COVID fears, or you don't have them at all, go see it in the cinema. Like, this is one when blown up. I mean, there were IMAX releases of Black Widow, which I think that would ultimately be the best way to see it, because there are enough action pieces that you will really, really, especially big, when they go certain places, like the wide shots will be amazing on an IMAX. I saw it on a 2D, you know what I mean, a normal screen, and it was perfectly adequate. I always sit in G7, if you ever want to know where I'm at, the cinema, that's my seat, and I loved it. Like, I absolutely loved it. And this, the thing I would say for first impressions that I noticed as well, this was a really long film. I went to see this at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, and I was really worried, because I was like, I'm tired, I know I'm going film. At the end of the day, but I really don't want this drug, because usually what happens is then it gets to like 10 o'clock and all I'm doing is checking my watch being like, I like the film, but I really like it to go so I can go home now. That wasn't the case at all with this one. I mean, even the credits, I was still there like, is there more gonna happen like, are they gonna do an end credit again? I'm not going anywhere. I want to see what happens. That's what I mean, like, this will have you on the edge of your seat the entire time, which is really what you want from a tentpole film. So sorry, my first impression and recommendation, go see it in the cinema if you can.
Yes.
Totally understand people that are like, it's not safe and I don't want to do that.
I mean, that was me.
That's
that
legitimate. You know what I mean?
I didn't want to go to a theater.
I've been going, you know, as long as the theaters have been open, I've been going. Now, I always wear a mask and they still, at my cinema, they still socially distance. So you still have, you know, two seats either side of you. But, you know, and there are people in the cinemas now that aren't wearing masks. So again, like, totally understand. But if you can, go out and see it in the theaters.
Absolutely.
Okay, so putting that to a side, so you're going to go away and you're going to watch Black Widow now, and then you're going to come back, you're going to listen, we're going to talk about a few other things. What is, you know, we were talking about today over the table today, but what are some of the cool things you've got this weekend?
Just in general, stuff that I watched.
Yeah, man, something cool.
I've managed to finish Loki, which was amazing. I know you haven't yet, but we will probably talk about it on another podcast in one of these little sections, but really, really good, really fun, like, sets stuff up moving forward in a really, really interesting way. And like I was telling you, I've been watching a lot of Second World War documentaries, a lot of the Nazi Hunter stuff on Netflix. I mean, I love Second World War and history. And
well, you're not in the minority either. Maybe I'll ask you that. Like, why do you, those are some of the, all of those shows, all the World War II stuff. If you go through like popular on Netflix, I'm telling you, especially if you do it like late at night. And late at night, I don't know if it's all us men or something like that, but there is a ton of people. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there's such an obsession with watching that stuff?
Well, I think
you were talking about it earlier, and I think you made some really good points.
As I was mentioning to you earlier when we were eating and stuff, I think There's definitely a fascination in England because, you know, like, grandparents, stuff like that.
People, part of your history.
Yeah, people talk about it in a way here where it's just still very front and center in the psyche. But I think the other thing is the fascination with how it's possible for how it was possible for it to get to that point. You know, and we talked a little bit about that and the apathy of people letting stuff reach points of no return or points where any objective person would say this is unacceptable, you know. And so it's always very interesting, particularly like the earlier stuff. There's a really good one called Hitler a Career, which is like from, you know, when he was in hospital after a mustard gas attack in the First World War, where he heard that the First World War had ended, they'd signed an armistice, you know, all the way till the end of the war. And it's just fascinating to see how this crazed individual managed to like change a whole country's way of thinking into something that was so barbaric and so kind of out there. I think that
you,
for me,
I mean,
is,
do you think,
is
do you think there are any echoes of that today? You know what I mean?
I think so. Yeah. You mentioned that, earlier today as well. And I completely agree. I think it's one of the problems that we've, you know, seen in recent times all over the world, not just in America, where the easy example is, you know, the presidency of a certain individual, but, you know, extreme right in Greece, in
Hungary,
yeah, sure. even in Germany and in Austria, you know, these places where we talked about it, like these places that really tried really hard to denazify, to unbrainwash people, you know, and there's still people who find that ideology appealing, and it's,
yeah, it's just, I mean, I guess the ideology part's where I can bring it back to where I come from, right? Mm. Like, you know, just to mark this in history and in case it's in any interest to the listeners, you know, right now we are still in not the grips, I would say, of COVID. Everyone thinks we're kind of on the tail end of it.
Yeah.
But no one's quite sure, because you have problems like in my country, you have a very strong political anti-vax program. So our parties, for some reason, have split on this. And I don't want to say it's Republicans that are actively saying don't vaccinate. It's more like we had the Tea Party before, which became Trump, you know, which they're not the same people, before I get crucified on this. Like, but you had the other far-right group, which was Trump's people. And Trump's people grow. Like, where I come from in Ohio, he's huge. Yeah, like, he had rallies, you know, just up the road from where I grew up. And listen, I'm not knocking people who follow him either. I'm just saying they're misguided. And it's because, you know, this is what happens. Where I come from in the Midwest, it's still, I never was poor, but Jesus, a lot of people are. You know what I mean? And that's one of those horrible things. It's horrible that I say it like that, because I never suffered living out there. But Jesus, I know so many factory towns where people aren't doing anymore. And nothing's changed, Trump or Biden. So those people have a hard time accepting anything, because it's like, no one cares.
And I think you made a really good point. I think we were in the car where you're like, the problem is that we don't listen to these people and we don't address some of the legitimate issues that they have.
That's right, because one person has come and do this, and this was the same. This is where I see the parallels. And just like Adolf Hitler, you know, Trump came in and said, I hear you.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's a problem for you. I will fix this. He went to the coal miners in West Virginia, which is only one state over for me.
Right.
And it's a very dicey issue, because, what, you know, they had the same problem in this country. Like, you can't source it's coal not, anymore. It's going to kill us. Like, we're all going to die. So we have to do it. But what do you tell a guy whose family for six generations,
that's all they've done. Yeah.
Like, oh, just get a new job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, retrain. That's the problem, is that's the mentality we all kind of have. Not just the left, not just whatever, but most people will say, like, well, get another job then, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's what leads to things like this, and why I find it interesting that you talk about that when we had a longer talk today about it. Yeah. That being said, guys, like, trust me, these people come around in history all the time. Sometimes it triggers, sometimes it doesn't. I like that kind of stuff, because it proves to the Western world that things are not nearly as simple and civilized as we ever make them out to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Good people can become monsters in a heartbeat.
Right. And this is why I watch some of these documentaries, you know?
Sure,
because it does kind of open your eyes that you have to be on guard. You have to, you know, when certain thing, I mean, you know, we were joking a little bit about it today, but the whole Jeff Bezos into space.
Well, this
thing
is the thing. Yeah. It's very funny when you put Ed, myself, and my wife in the same, this is why we've been friends for so long, all three of us, because we are very different sides of the spectrum. Now, you know, I have to fully admit, I'm the, what do we say, the whiny bitch, but I'm not a whiny bitch. I'm the one who's uber. I believe you have to fight the fight, like, all the time. You know what I mean? And so if you've ever met me, like, I have a lot of opinions, and I voice them very loudly, and I don't compromise on certain things, like racism, not someone who compromises on that, on, you know, clapping back against bad businesses that are hurting their employees and taking jollies into space. Like, no, you're not going to get a sympathy card from me on that, because I just don't think it's a good idea in the middle of COVID for people to be taken off into space. Now, is it my business? Like, nah. You know what I mean? Right. And do I work in insurance? Like, sure. You know what I mean? Like, I get it, guys. I don't know everything about anything, but that's my position. My wife tends to be the other side of that spectrum, to live and let live, you know, and it's like, if it's not bothering you, then what's the problem? And Ed, you always float somewhere kind of in the middle.
In the middle, yeah.
That's why we always like having you around. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's just interesting. And that's what I mean. Like, there's no one answer to any of this, but I do think we all have to be mindful of the world around us. You don't want to just bury your head in the sand. So, no, that's cool, Ed. That's very cool.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, for my end this week, what would be it? I guess the one I had the most fun with this week, and it was surprising fun, is Schmigadoon.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we talked about this.
Because the name is just ridiculous. You know what I mean? Yeah. Schmigadoon! Yeah. And, like, I knew nothing about this other than, like, I watched the trailer.
Yeah.
And they said they were going to go into a musical, and I was like, oh, I might like this.
Yeah,
I might like this. I might not like this. Then I saw that Lorne Michaels is the guy behind it. Now, do you know who that is?
Yeah, Saturday Night Live.
That's right. So that's the creator and kind of the runner, the guy who's been running that for all those years. Very good, you know, producer.
Like, yeah, I mean, he launched the careers of so many people. Yeah.
So, and it was interesting because I watched this with my wife, which is a great show to watch with another person because it's a couple film. It's a couple show.
Uh-huh.
Like, the protagonists are a couple.
Yeah.
But we had the exact reaction of the people on the show. Like, there's one character that loves the musical element of what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's the girl. And then there's the guy who's like, this is stupid. You know what I mean? And my wife and I pretty much took those positions on opposite sexes. So, of course, I was the, you know, if you've been around this household long enough, you know that's exactly how it would happen every time. You know what I mean? Like, I was the one who was like, oh, it's the musicals. They're beautiful. I think I'll sing a couple myself. And my wife was like, this is really, really dumb. So, but I really, it was one of those things, I think it's because it surprised me. Like, the first one, it is over the top. Like, is every 5 seconds another song about something. And I thought that was going to kill me, but it just kept making me laugh. I kept giggling the whole way through it.
I think I'm going to like it.
So, yeah, give it a watch and tell us what you think. I think episode 3 comes out on Friday. So you can get up to episode 3, and maybe we'll talk about it on this little break that we have in between kind of first looks and whatever next week. But, yeah, check it out. Everyone that's out there, give it a watch. It's Apple TV again. Another reason I love Apple TV that I found out, the one thing I will say about Schmigadoon is very American. Okay, everything I see on Apple TV, aside from Ted Lasso, because that was a joint collaboration, is much more geared toward an American audience. And I don't mean that with any disrespect English. I just don't feel it.
Not in a bad way.
No, it was like, it's like,
sometimes Netflix overdoes it with trying to be, you know, the world streaming service, and because they do a lot of collaborations with Spain and France and
trying to get to the that's a really good point, a good side point, because man, getting to the bottom of that though on Netflix, it takes forever to find, let's say, like, you know me, so I only mean this for a very narcissistic way, that I speak umpteen languages, I like things from around the world, but man, if I want to find something like that's hot in Japan right now, scrolling through the Netflix windows to try to get to that is impossible. I just go online and I'll be like, well, it's hot in Japan right now,
Google it.
Then I have to, like, and it's just, I'm sorry, it's one of those things, it's not really, it's definitely a white-collar problem, because all I'm talking about is having to go to my computer to tell me what to watch on Netflix, but why can't Netflix just take me there, you know? Like, why can't we just be there already?
Yeah. So. Ted Lasso's coming back as well, season 2, I'm so excited about that.
I know.
It's like this week, next week? It's
next week, yeah, next week.
Oh, so exciting.
20-something, oh, maybe this week, yeah, the 20-something.
We're gonna do an episode on
Lasso. We will, I have to push you back, Mitch, might have to push back. I'm sorry, Mitch.
Yeah.
But okay, so breaking into Black Widow proper and thinking about the best way to kind of tackle this for our filmmaking buddies, because we like to talk about why this film is tentpole, why this film is amazing. So understand, if you haven't joined us on the show before, and I should have said this at the outset, we are indie filmmakers. That's what we do. We both have other jobs. You know, I have a very dominant kind of first job. Ed has two other side jobs to help us out. Like, it's tough. But in the same sense, this is us telling you this is how we look at it. This is what we take away from it to make our films better. And this is what we would suggest to you to look at it to see why it was done so well. So where do you want to start with it? I mean, I can talk about production, but that's more of a kind of a wrap-up kind of thing at the end to mention that. Like, where do you think this film is the strongest?
I think it's got to be the cast.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it when we're vibing like that. Because, I would definitely say, and it will surprise you, because all-star casts usually with me are like, oh no.
Yeah, you worry.
Like,
because
Jesus.
People are going to be competitive and trying to outshine each other.
Sometimes it works. A lot of times it doesn't. Like, I just, from my experience, like, the more A-list actors you list together, the more I'm like, uh-oh.
Do you know a perfect example of that? Talking about Second World War stuff. There's a movie called The Monument Men, which is Second World War, and it's based on a true story about a group of, like, art history professors who were put together into a unit and sent to France after D-Day to try and save art from the Nazis and stuff like that. And it's got Matt Damon, it's got, like, Bill Murray. It's like, the cast, every name, you'd be like, oh my God, he's amazing. Like, he's in everything. And yet, something's just not quite there.
No, I mean, the one I always argue with people, now, I did love this film, but most people did not, as star-studded cast in the Jarmusch film that I love. What is it? The Dead Don't Die?
Oh, yeah, I still haven't seen that. That's,
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite. Now, Tilda, I know you've done so many, like, I just so need to be in a room with you.
Love Tilda.
You're so amazing, right, with everything you do. But in this one, she plays a Scottish samurai, like... That fights, I think she's an alien as well, ruining this film for you.
Oh,
but
no, that's selling it.
It's Jarmusch, you know what I mean? Yeah. He's nuts. He's absolutely
Isn't
nuts.
Isn't it Bill Murray and...
Bill Murray, Adam Driver and there's a bunch of others. And the problem was, like, it is Jarmusch, so it's very deadpan. Like, again, we were explaining what Wes Anderson was to my wife, who was like, I don't get it. And we're like, that's the point. Like, most people that like his stuff will be like, that's the point, that you're not supposed to, like, you know, whatever. But... Yeah, I mean, that was ultimately, like, a commercial failure, because they had all these A-list actors that they thought would bring to it, and it was like, no. I can think of a couple of those. Brad Pitt's in a bunch of those, where they put him in something that's actually, it's usually pretty good. Like, his films, I've never really seen a bad Brad Pitt film, but the all-star cast, and then all of a sudden you're like, you just lose the will to want to go. I don't know why that happens.
It's funny, yeah. Sometimes it can be a plus, sometimes it can be a negative.
Moving on to this one. I mean, our star-studded cast, we have Scarlett Johansson, which you'll never hear a bad word from me about, but that's you know, that's the way it is. Elizabeth Pugh.
Florence Pugh.
Sorry, why did I call you?
Because Elizabeth Olsen, we always get... I do that as well.
Okay, so Florence Pugh. Sorry, Florence. Also one of my favorite actresses, and man, did you blow it away in this one.
Oh,
like...
So good.
So good, right? Who's the other big one?
David Harbour.
Oh, and then this is what I mean. And then the other good one.
Rachel Weisz. Yeah.
So, and we can talk spoilers now. I mean, they all form the part of this kind of loose family.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a little bit like if anyone of our listeners has ever watched The Americans, which was a show on FX about a deep cover Soviet spy.
How much did you love that they were in Ohio?
Yeah,
like,
no.
That's right.
Jason's gonna love this.
Yeah, well, because that's what we think, at least. Ohio is like, there's sleeper cells everywhere. Those Ruskies.
So they're playing a family, a mother, a father. So Rachel Weisz plays the mother, David Harbour plays the father, and then you've got two little girls, one of which, by the way, I don't know if you realize this, I was like, of course, afterwards. But the little girl with the blue hair who plays Natasha Romanoff.
Yeah, yeah, young Romanoff.
Yeah, she is Mila Jovovich's daughter.
I can see that now.
Yes, completely right.
The same hair and a similar
same
face.
Eye. Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Similar face. Yeah.
So you get a little flashback at the beginning and you get them basically having to leave their secret lives to the Russia?
Yeah.
To the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and that's the thing. When we talked about in the opening bits, because we're going to meld a little story into this as well.
Yes.
But when we talked about in the opening bits, like, one of the biggest things that this film does well is taking you to unexpected places. So, you know Natasha, at least they're assuming to a certain extent, you don't have to at all, but they're assuming to a certain extent that you know a little bit about Natasha Romanoff's background.
Yeah.
And that, you know, she's the Black Widow, she's an Avenger, she's a spy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the first scene where you said Ohio, and you see them all, and they are acting as a family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, that's part of the acting being amazing, because they act very, very, very much like a family. You really don't know exactly what's going on.
And it's funny because the visuals are very familiar. It's Middle America, family.
They play in the playground in the beginning.
Yeah, playing in the playground, the neighborhood.
Dad comes home from dinner.
From work for dinner.
They did poach an awful, you say typical Midwest. They're poaching a lot of what we saw in Stranger Things. Like, it had a very, very 80s...
Yeah.
You know, and this is the 90s, so this is supposed to be like 96.
Yeah, 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 right.
So, which it looked, trust me, the Midwest doesn't age very much at all.
Right.
So it
we
looked
were
the
talking
same,
about Napoleon Dynamite.
I don't teach you that. But, so, you have this picture of this perfect family, and that's, for me, I was just kind of sitting there the whole time being like, is this really Natasha's family? Like, what's going on here? Because I'm pretty sure she becomes a spy at some point. Right,
right. Is this her mother and her father?
Like,
and
how
did
this really happen? Yeah, and I'm telling you, like, it's almost like a, what is your favorite thing you used to call it? Type of shot. Where you, a smash cut.
Yes, yes.
And it's not, because it's actually a credit sequence done to a female version of
Smells Like Teen Spirit,
which is haunted by these pictures of these girls being picked up off the street and being taken to what you'll later find out is the Red Room.
Yeah. So, like, shipping containers, and immediately with that, you get the thing.
Right now, I've got my goosebumps on. Why? Because that's what happens. Because you realize you're not in a typical MCU film.
You're not. You're watching an
it
MCU
gets
film
dark really,
with
really
a
fast.
Really important message. And the thing that maybe I love the most about that element is that I don't think they smashed it over our heads. I don't think that it was like.
No, you still don't really know what's going on. Because this happens, so the scene that happens is the scene in Cuba. Mm. They're in Cuba trying to escape because they've done this really great Russian...
Yeah, they've stolen some information, what
they're
doing.
Right, and so you're starting to slowly get the real characters, which you will find out much later in the film about who all these people are.
Mm.
But there's the two girls, and it's like you're literally watching this family unit get ripped apart, and... You know, one of the characters, the lead male character, is so indoctrinated, he's just happy about the whole thing. Yeah. And it's like, we've done it. The woman, you can tell she's upset, but like, she's...
Yeah, there's a motherly, like, concern.
There's definitely
vibe.
A motherly thing there, but there's also this eerie distance there. Yeah. Because, and if I remember in Cuba, she's also not really there, because they take her out of the picture.
She gets shot, I think,
and that
in the escape. How exciting was that escape, though?
Exactly, and story-wise, by pulling her out of there... Sorry, we are having a very active session here. But by pulling her out of there, it sets up the later surprise that happens, you know, when you're later in the film. There's another kind of reveal that happens that you didn't know, and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
She gets pulled off very quickly, and then there's the father, and the father basically gives them up.
Yeah, he's like, don't worry... Like, he gives them a little pep. I know my girls are the strongest girls.
Yeah,
I think that was in the trailer.
And you just, like, the whole point is you were supposed to be those girls now because you don't believe them.
You're
like, what are they doing? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so then when you smash cut, like I said, to that Teen Spirit song, a very slow version of Smells Like Teen Spirit, I'll put it on. It'll probably be what you heard coming into this because I'll find it and put it on the opening of the podcast.
Mm.
So that song, then done with all of these really haunting images of either images of missing girls, girls getting picked up off the... I mean, I'm not kidding. They dive you right into the middle of this.
Human trafficking at its, like, most visceral, you know? And I think that that's...
And so that's not... Like, I'm not trying to be contrarian, but it almost smashes you over the head. It's like, it's...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It takes, like, what this is going to be about and smashes you over the head.
Yes, but I guess what I meant was overall
in
the film.
No, like...
Because I was a little bit confused by the sequence, like, that sequence, because I was like, wait, did this happen before, or did it happen after? In the moment. Later on, I got it and stuff like that.
Yeah, I know. And I know what you mean. I think... That's another thing that's amazing about this one, and it brings me back to... There was an article in Variety, which is... I read that incessantly these days, but there was an article in Variety about Florence Pugh's kind of fight back over this line that she had.
Yes.
And she has this line that she plays, this great character, Elena, who, by the time you meet her as an adult, is very jaded.
Yelena
is very jaded because she's been an assassin most of her life. You know, in the film, like, as I said, you've watched it by now, you know that she's only recently been let go of the Red Room.
Right. She gets hit by, like, a gas that kind of breaks her like, mind control. And, I mean...
And that was the interesting point. That's when you find out that the mind control she's under is actually even worse.
It's different. It's chemical.
It's a chemical mind control. So they are fully in control of almost everything.
Right.
It's just they have to do what they're told. Like,
right.
Different from, like... She was just describing the old methods where they used to just not have any control. And so it was like... You know, they just watched as their body went. With this one, like, they don't know whether it's them telling them to do something or something else.
And it's illustrated with one of the Black Widows who gets injured after she's been chasing the two kind of main characters. She breaks her leg, she falls out of a window, and she's forced to kill herself. And she's, like, she's clearly there, and she's like, I don't want to do this, like, you know.
So in this Florence Pugh scene, like, she's on a copter ride, basically talking to her what was her dad, but it's not really her dad, right, but this guy who pretended to be her dad, and they're fighting because he's very proud, and she's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
But then he, like, starts to learn about what they did to her.
Yeah,
and
what
she,
happened to them.
She makes this joke. She's very tough. She has to be, right? That's part of the reason that the film works, is because Yelena is this uber tough, like, young character. But she's talking about a hysterectomy, and she's like, no, they go right in there, and they just rip them out, everything.
Yeah.
They just rip out the ovaries, and he can't take it.
Yeah.
And what message that was giving about, like, the male dominance of that scene, like, was just amazing.
Yeah.
The way that she was pulling it away from him and saying, yeah, you can't even talk about this without getting shortness of breath.
Yeah.
I would say that kind of unveiled the theme of the whole movie. Mm-hmm. This was a very, very feminine film.
Yeah.
And why? Not because the lead actresses were everything, but because it talks about the oppression still existing, you know, in the world today for these, you know, men do not worry about getting taken away in captive.
And, you know, the whole, like, right to choose and
right
to men
choose,
telling women
sex
what
trafficking,
to do with their
it
bodies.
It was all dealt with, like, so well in this by saying, like, this could happen, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, just by this being able to happen, you are literally exposed, shining a light on the fact that women have it harder than we do, and men do, you know, with this kind of stuff. There are more things to worry about, you know, with I guess, you know, you could say the patriarchy and stuff.
Yeah, completely.
Not
completely.
Like I know any of this. So if a feminist wants to get on and be like, Jason, you're talking about your ass, like, fine, I'm sorry. Like,
I think,
the fact that it had a very strong
theme,
feminine message.
Yeah, yeah. The central theme was very clear. It was a clear vision.
About how disposable females are sometimes treated in our society, you know, like
completely
disposable.
Yeah. So Scarlett Johansson, she obviously plays Natasha Romanoff, who's the main character, and Florence Pugh plays Yelena Romanoff. I guess, no, it's not Yelena Romanoff. I can't remember what her name is.
No, it's okay. It's like, it's not her little sister, but
Yelena
it's
Belova.
Sister.
That's right. And she's also gone through the Black Widow program, which
The Red Room program,
which is the Red Room and stuff like that. And her father, her fake father, played by David Harbour, is actually a superhero.
The Red Guardian. Yeah. Those of you that read the comic books will love that, because, you know, obviously it's the super soldiers from the different places.
Yeah.
So the Red Guardian was the one from Russia that's injected.
I love when they kind of, like, when I think it was Yelena, she was like, weren't you like the Red Dynamo or something like that?
He goes through, this is the thing, like, again, showing, like, people who are too heavily indoctrinated, that's his character. And so up until pretty much, I would say, the last, you know, third act, he's very much still very proud of, I mean, he's in prison.
Totally. That whole section in prison where he's telling stories.
And he's
about,
just obsessed with, like, I was
Captain
this amazing
America,
guy. And
he
can't get it through his head that, like, no one cares about him anymore. And
he's
just been, you know, discarded by you know, by this guy that didn't really care about him in the slightest.
And you know, his daughters, like, kind of throw that in his face, and there's just a great family dynamic, not just at the beginning of the film where they're playing a family.
Yeah, I mean, it's something like, I was thinking, like, it's very, you know, high concept writing, because I think, you know, you've got elements there talking about what does it mean to be a family.
Yes.
And I wouldn't expect that in an MCU film at all. Like,
I mean, well, to be fair, like,
Guardians kind of dealt with that, but in a really kind of...
Yeah, in a funny kind of throwaway kind of way.
Yeah, misfit kind of way, which is usually how that's done, like Road Trip style, where
and,
it's like...
The Avengers kind of touched on it a little bit with, like, Civil War, like, you know, the brothers fighting and...
Exactly,
like that.
But nothing like this.
Nothing
where you're talking about raising people and like a family unit. And it was like, we weren't a family, but we would rather have the fakeness of being a family than the reality of what really happened. And it was like, wow, like, that is interesting, isn't it? To say that you would rather have a false you know, narrative than, and it makes complete sense in the movie. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I think they're onto something with it. I think that's something that's happening today in the world. And, you know, it's just the kind of thing, I haven't quite got my brain around what that means, but I, you know, kudos to the people who do, because they're saying something there. They're saying something about the way we look at family in modern society.
And they did such a great job of keeping it within the MCU world, because, you know, there was parallels between, you know, because this takes place
in between
just after
Civil War. So the,
Civil War.
After the big fight between
The Avengers have split up. And
yeah, so you know, you have the famous fight, Black Panther fights with the Winter Soldier and with Steve, you know, with Captain America. And they finally get to the bottom of...
Spider-Man shows up and Germany, right? At the airport and stuff.
Yeah, but even after that. Because then you have the revelation. Tony Stark, of course, finds out. So I'll just walk you through it. You know, Tony Stark finds out that Winter Soldier killed his dad.
Right.
And that happens after the Germany scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's that last fight where, for some reason, I think Black Panther is trying to protect Iron Man.
No, it's... Wait, is Black Panther in that last one? I thought it was Iron Man, Captain America,
Black Panther fights in Germany.
Yeah.
And then you move on to the last scene.
Yeah.
But he's there too, because it's the final fight between Black Panther and Captain America, and I can't remember if it's between Winter Soldier and Captain America Winter Soldier and Black Panther, but there's this like, okay, you go, you know, you understand what the problem was, we're sorry we involved you in this, but you go back to Wakanda and everything will be alright. I think. I have to remember it, but that's the last battle is Steve Rogers, Winter Soldier, Black Panther, and Iron Man.
Mm.
Because obviously the big battle is between Iron Man and Cap at the end, where they just kind of have to, you know, agree to disagree, so to speak.
But
Scarlett Johansson's on the Black Widow is on the run after that.
Yeah, because she flips because she's originally with Iron Man, and then she lets them go.
In the airport, you know, because she's friends with Steve.
Yeah, but it. So, what were we saying? This is the wine. This is the problem.
The wine is talking now. I think what we were talking about is how, you know, Avengers dealt with
family,
the concept of family.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
this,
yeah.
This
and
of,
this one did a really good job of adding new layers to it and new dimensions, but still keeping it grounded in the MCU.
That's what you were saying.
Which is the amazing bit of writing.
Generally, this is very much, I would say 99.9% of this is firmly rooted in the MCU. Now, I did raise, and I just because I can raise it on a podcast, and it is a bit funny. The only thing I said to Ed was just, listen, at the end now, and you guys have all watched this now, so you know what I'm talking about. Like, okay, so the Red Room is a floating fortress in the sky. Have we seen floating fortresses in the sky? Oh, wait, we have. We've seen lots of fortresses in the sky. And they claim that the Red Room was hidden. Like, maybe I missed that part.
Behind a cloud.
Yeah, like, maybe I missed that part of how that worked. But I was like, how in God's name have the Avengers not, like, run smack dab into this?
Right, I imagine. You know, flown
into it. With the carrier and been like, what did we just hit? I thought there was a cloud. You know, if I was driving, because most people on the podcast will know what I'm like as a driver. If I was driving, that's what would happen, you know? Like,
yeah, it was a bit of a suspension of disbelief. And I think this film does suffer a tiny, tiny little bit from the things that people often accuse these big tentpole movies of, which I think is a little bit of ridiculousness, but you know, it's...
What that is, Ed, and you know what it is, because we've talked about this, it's writer's room insertion. So what happens is, like, you know, this is why I say watch the Saw movies, because it makes you, if you watch all the Saw movies together, whether you love them or hate them, you know, and if you take it at face value, you will say, like, wow, that is some brilliant writing. Like, that is like, wow, how did they know that this was all going to happen? The answer is they didn't. You know what I mean? When they wrote it, and then they get the script out, and they're like, okay, we have to make a sequel. Where do we put some holes here? Where can we fill in the gaps? And so then you can fill in the gaps there. And they managed to do that for, like, 8 films. Even I just watched, that was one of the first films I saw coming back to the cinema was the one with Chris Rock, which was really good. But... yeah, I mean, that's hole filling. You know what I mean? That's basically taking a scene and saying, okay, we can add something in there because nobody will have noticed that we had that there. So that's what I think happens here to a certain extent. Like, I don't know, Kevin Feige is the master, and he is a person that has a blueprint for all this. So I think for 99.999% of it, the blueprint was there, because they all say that Kevin is adamant about that everything has to link in. I just think they did get to a point where they were like, what are we going to do?
Okay. Yeah, the Red Room can't just be in a place, so where could
it be? Yeah, you can't put it in, like, Sokovia, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, because, you know, they'd have found it or whatever, right? But, my other issue, and this does kind of link in a little bit with the cast and stuff like that, is, and I love this man, but Ray Winston is one of my all-time favorite actors. I love him in virtually everything he's in. And I don't think it was his fault. I thought his performance was good.
I feel bad. Who is Ray Winston?
The bad guy.
I know who he is. No, in the movie. But like, who? What else would I know him from acting wise?
Oh, that's a tough one. You might know him from, like, the betting ads that go on all the time here.
Okay.
But he's basically a guy who became famous in the 70s for doing like hard men. So he did this movie called Scum, like where he's like a kid who's like gone to juvie and he's played a lot of hard men. There's one film that if you haven't seen, we're gonna watch. I'm saying it right now.
Okay,
it's called Love, Honor and Obey. It's got Jude Law. It's got Tommy Lee Jones. The guy who plays Sherlock, he was in Trainspotting. He was married to Angelina Jolie for a hot minute.
Johnny Lee Miller,
thank you. He's in it.
Wait, and is that the one where he gets axed at the end?
Yes. Yeah
you
he's
made
a
me watch that in Korea.
Oh, okay. You there gave you that go.
To me in Korea. And yeah. He's like, he's in the car and they yeah. just like the other movie that did that with Bob Hoskins.
No. Sorry. That's a different one.
Okay.
That's the long.
No, you're thinking of the Bob Hoskins one. I'm talking this other one, though. It's a similar scene. Like, he's literally like in the clown. I don't think you ever
in
seen
in the clown
him,
outfit. Yeah.
I don't
yeah,
think
yeah.
you ever see him get shot, but he goes into the car and he's never coming
you're
back.
You're right. Yeah, 100%.
So, yeah, you gave that film to me in Korea.
Yeah.
15 years ago.
It's one of my all time favorite films.
It's hilarious when we do this kind of stuff because, like, no, I've seen that. I remember because you said this is an English gangster film. You need to watch this.
And he plays like the top gangster in that film.
Okay, so he's like the Bricktop.
Yeah.
Like for me, unfortunately, Snatch is always like the ultimate British gangster film, movie, and Bricktop is the ultimate British gangster. Only because one of my best friends, Alex West, I love you, man. Mm. He like looks like Bricktop. Like nice. Just looks like him. He's East London Cockney guy that just like can scare the crap out of you.
And so so Ray Winston, to me, the character was a bit like half-baked. And Taskmaster, I really liked the concept of it, and when he was fighting and like, but the reveal at the end, I was like, it ends up that it was his daughter who the Black Widow had like basically bombed, and he had like saved her and made her into this like machine basically. And it's Olga Kurylenko, who I really like as well as an actress.
I remember her from, since she did some of the Bond films. One of the Bond films.
Yeah, I think so. She was in Eastern Promises as well, which is a great Russian gangster movie.
She plays Quantum of Solace. She's the one opposite him on that one.
Yeah. But again, she had nothing to do, and it was...
No, I mean, taking that in turn, like Ray Winston's character has one really powerful scene, which I think he did well, like... That last scene where she is breaking him, but you don't know he's breaking him, that's tough because he's a guy that is like, he has to be the Harvey Weinstein of the scene. And really, that's the kind of vibes
that's
I was getting.
That's a really good analogy.
That's the vibes I was getting from this film. That's why I liked it so much because I'm like, this is a good way of showcasing what we're talking about when we say Me Too and we say like, this is a problem because this is how these women are treated on a superficial level. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or maybe not even on a superficial level, on some level, you know, in Hollywood. And they're talking about the disposability of that. And he has to be that way. He has to be, you know, and you know, I could give you stories as to why I know this is what it is, but he's being the abusive guy. Mm. You know what I mean? And like
that scene,
he is diminishing her. Yeah. He's diminishing her in front of him. And that's
physically, imposing on her.
And it's a mental thing too, though, because he's demeaning her and saying you don't matter. You're nothing. Totally. You're nothing without
me. It's a pimp, right?
You know, it's a thing. You're nothing without me. Right. And I think he pulled that off really well in a scene.
It's a really good point. I hadn't thought of it from that.
Could have been really difficult to do that because, you know, the minute you sound even the remotest chappy or nice, you're going to pull out of that scene. It's not going to look authentic and it's going to look like she's just looking to kill. But the whole time through, like, he's just despicable. And you're just like, this is horrible.
Yeah.
For Taskmaster, like, I was really confused about that because I've, you know, if you've played Spider-Man the video game, the one that's on PS4 and PS5 now, like, Taskmaster is one of the characters in that. I think, as I said, Yelena was one of them as well.
Okay.
But Taskmaster is this odd, like, thing that makes you do all this stuff. And you never quite know the background. So I think the problem, again, is what MCU has always had problems with when it comes to its villains.
Yes.
So... Never had as much of a problem with its heroes, surprisingly, but with its villains, when they're tied to the comics like that, like there's just not
they're
enough.
They're a bit disposable,
breath. So Taskmaster is recognizable. It'd be someone you'd be like, oh, I know who that is in the comics. And so I think they were really kind of bound to keep them that way. It definitely looked like you would see it in the other things. Mm. And I think that's what hurts it. It's supposed to be a reconstructed girl. Like, I would have just designed that costume and everything about that a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to make it more impactful that this is literally the body of the girl who got crumbled when she was supposed to be. And they never do explain, by the way, or do they, where he was.
No. Yeah, they don't explain how, whether he just wasn't there. Cause so the Black Widow, Natasha Romanoff, in order to get away from the Red Room and defect to S.H.I.E.L.D., become a spy for them and an Avenger and all that.
Yeah, she, right before you see her in Iron Man 2. So yeah, this would exactly. all happen right before Iron Man 2.
So she plants a bomb where she thinks that this guy is who runs the Red Room. And the only way that she thinks she can know that he's definitely there is because his daughter comes after school. She's a little girl, and she shows up, and she goes up.
And you know what? I got the feeling, and this wasn't a detriment to the movie. The movie was great, but I get the feeling that there were scenes cut about this because
I wonder.
Because this is the scene. So when you get to Avengers Endgame, like this is the scene that she's talking about, where she thinks it's okay for her to die, because she feels like she killed somebody.
Yeah.
So she's like, "No, it's my turn."
It's kind of her biggest.
I have to atone for this.
Yeah. Thank you. Jay's just opening the door because I'm sweating like I'm...
No, it's all right. It's moths or... Here, we'll turn the lights on. Maybe the moths won't come in.
Yeah.
So, they're hanging out in Chateau de Chiraux.
Oh, no.
There you go, buddy. Okay. But, I think the really cool thing about the way that was done is it's still adequate. Like, it doesn't take away from the story. It doesn't... You know, not having that full explanation of like how guilty she felt, even though you see little bits of it.
Yeah.
I just thought maybe you could have a little bit more, but it's a 2.5 hour film. So I imagine they had to be like, well, what do we keep? What do we keep out? But that's what I mean. Like, there's definitely the elements of there. That's where if you watch the other films, so Civil War, Iron Man 2, like they have them all on Disney Plus right now. It's the coolest thing. Like, if you want to just watch all the Black Widow stuff, you can watch Black Widow, go to the theaters, watch it. And then you can watch like all the other stuff that she has a major like part of, which I just find helpful because if you want your backstory on the rest of her story, because she talks about this thing all the time
and
you never know what she's talking about.
And the scene in Infinity War where she tells Banner that she can't have children because of, you know, what happens when they graduate.
Yeah.
Just like it sewed it all together so well. And I guess that was my other apprehension about this. It felt like they'd push this back, as in a Black Widow standalone movie.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, are they just going to like throw out whatever?
No,
you heard,
it was on the podcast that I was talking to you about this. Like, Scarlett Johansson generally is like one of my favorite actresses. Mm. I just seen so many good movies that she's in. I'm like, yes, like, let's make her even more iconic because it's just, you know, I like to see an actress doing well. You know what I mean? That's really cool. And it was like, how is this going to work? I'd seen the trailer for Black Widow like 10 billion times. It's the same thing I say about James Bond.
They've been showing it for a while.
Now they've changed the trailer on James Bond, which is awesome. Oh, like they've got a new trailer to kind of get you back into it.
Okay, that's
And I
smart.
Thought that was a good turn on this. But Black Widow, it was like, how is this going to work? Like, and the way it worked is they hadn't... The trailer is a good trailer. It doesn't really tell you much about the film at all. Which is, you know, that would be, unfortunately, we're so... geek heavy and happy about this film, you're not going to get a whole lot of instruction as to like what do good filmmakers do. Not like we'd know anyway, right? But this one, the trailer was made such that I said, if you're going to do anything like story style or try to think of how this worked, like the trailer never let on the full story,
right?
And you knew the full story. That's the thing, in the back of your head, like you knew it was a spy
Red
story
room spies,
and you still are knocked off your feet when they like give you the full results of what's happening, and you're like, wow, like that's grim, like 100%. That's really grim. So that's amazing to me. You know what I mean? The fact that I'd seen this trailer 6 billion times, I knew about it, was really worried it was going to be a big snooze fest for one of my favorite Avengers, and then they just knock it out of the park.
And I think I want to kind of reiterate why I said that the cast is, for me, the strongest thing about this film. When the film got going, there were a couple of scenes, particularly when they have the reunion. So Rachel Weisz, who disappears for a fair chunk of the film.
Yeah, basically until they drop from... It's the drop from Act 2 and Act 3, isn't it?
I think so, yes. Or it's just after they've rescued their father from jail, which is a great, great scene. The whole
and that's like
break.
That's your break into Act 2. So Act 2 is the prison break of him.
They go because he says, oh no, your mother's still alive, because I think they thought she was dead.
It's the midway point that she comes in. Yeah.
And they go to visit her, and she is on a pig farm, and she's like working with these pigs and stuff like that. But in that kind of section, they have like a sit-down meal, and it's the first time that they've been together since they ran away and stuff like
and
that.
Brilliant. Right? Sorry, just to point it out, brilliant foreshadowing. Again, story writing on this is like the best I've seen because you saw those pigs in the opening credits when they were playing the eerie music and everything was getting really disturbing.
I didn't notice that.
You saw the pigs. And so when I saw them again, I was like, something's up.
Yeah.
But they don't tell you what's up with the pigs right then and there at all. Like you generally have this family scene, I think, first.
Yeah. And the family scene for me was my favorite scene. First of all, Florence Pugh has such a powerful like speech where she kind of yells at them because they're all saying, I was fake, we weren't really a family, this and that. And she says, for me, it was real. And you really, really feel it.
That's, I think, why this works so well, Dad. Like, when you said speech, I said, that's why the acting was so natural.
So good.
Like, you really would believe that that Scarlett Johansson and you know, Florence Pugh were sisters.
Mm.
Like, and they're not. That's the funniest thing about it. Like, they're fake sisters. Yeah. They never were sisters to begin with. And, like, they still, by the end of it, you're like...
Their dynamic is so good.
So
like,
good.
She keeps
so
ripping
good.
On her for, like, her poses, right?
Yeah.
When she's like, why do you do that thing with your hair? And we're doing terrible Russian accents.
No. Which, you know, and that's the thing. Like, the Russian accent isn't amazing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a Russian accent. It's, you know, it's you know, Sean Connery's the only one that's ever been able to blow that completely away and be like, screw it, I'm not talking about Russian.
I'm
Scottish.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but you know, she does adequately enough. It wasn't, you know, no offense, Kate Blanchett, but it's the only film I've ever seen you that I didn't like you in. With Kate Blanchett Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I don't know what happened with that. Like, I don't ask me. It's a George Lucas film, so I could probably say it's all just right there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Point being, Florence Pugh's character with that kind of phony Russian accent, but she also adds in the only humor that you really have.
Yes.
Her in the Red Guardian, I guess.
Because
the Red Guardian is the one who's so over the top.
But he's kind of like, you laugh at him.
But she gets this humor in her speeches.
Yeah,
and so like when she's talking about the hysterectomy, like, they just get up in there and
rip
it all out. And it's like, wow, that's... And then she's talking to them and she's like, for me, it was real.
Yeah.
You know, like, it was. Like, I would rather have that than what I have
sister,
now.
You were my sister. You were my father. You were my...
Like, and it's not someone speeching. It's someone, like, talking to their family.
Yeah,
like, you assholes.
Yeah,
like, you know, why did you do this to me?
Like, amazing. Okay, so in that moment, I remember thinking, oh, Scarlett, shit, you got to step up, girl. Like, because at the same time, you've got David Harbour and you've got Rachel Weisz, who are... amazing actors.
And what did you think? I mean, I know what I would say to that, but I'd like to hear what you thought. I mean, what did you think? Do you think that she rose to the challenge?
100%. She 100%, like, by the end of the film, like, I was like, this might be her best role. And you know, she was so incredible in Jojo Rabbit, and she's Lost in Translation. I love all those films. They're incredible.
Scarlett Johansson and Jojo Rabbit. That was probably the one for me. I mean, it was either that or it was the same. I watched that Marriage Story probably within the same thing, and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like,
but here she's really the central character, you know?
She is, but this kind of, like, Jason always tells it through weird stories. Like, I lived out in L.A., and I used to go to church with, rest in peace, the good man, Kobes, because he went to the same church I did.
Yeah.
And I was out in L.A. when the Lakers had Kobe and Shaq and all them, and they sucked.
Yeah.
And it was because, like, don't get me wrong, I never had, like, personal conversations with Kobe about it. He used to laugh at me because I'd come in from a Saturday of drinking into Sunday to get my hands washed, and he'd be like, you look a little rough, you know? And it's always funny when Kobe Bryant tells you that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're like, okay.
All right, Kobe.
Thanks, Kobes. So, but, you know, in the same sense, that team could never get it together because, apparently, because no one wanted to, you know, Kobe always wanted that to be his team,
Eagles,
right?
Yeah.
Like, that was, he was trained for that. He was going to be the Michael Jordan of the team
kind
of thing. And it never worked because of that. And then they put all these guys in different places and then all of a sudden it worked. The reason this film works is because people actually made space for each other.
Yes.
So what I was trying, I guess the analogy I'm trying to make, or at least the point I'm trying to make, is that no one trips over each other acting-wise, which is normally where it all falls apart.
It's not...
Because the actors can't play together.
Yeah,
I want to be the same. You know, we were just talking about what I was telling you about, and sorry, Sophie, because I know she's one of your favorite, but who was it?
Meryl Streep
did this to other women
actresses.
She acted with, and how, you know, it was okayed by the directors.
Mm.
And that's the problem. Like, if you have multiple stars, they all need to shine.
Yeah.
Especially the hardest one would have been for Florence Pugh because she's the new one.
Exactly.
And so, but you have to let this be a breakout film for her. Otherwise, you know, it just...
And it so is, though. That's the thing.
Of course. Like, you know, she can get cast in so many other things now.
She is now on the radar of every single producer out
there. Well, and I was looking, man. She did a couple of those stunts, man. I was looking. I always look close now to see whether or not the actors are doing the stunts. I look at their faces to see if I can catch the stunt double. Mm. And usually I can. But this one, like, there were a couple really big scenes that it was her. I'm sure it was her. You know what I mean?
She was so, so, so good.
Prove me wrong if you want, by the way. Put it in the comments. But,
and, you know, Rachel Weisz again, like...
But thinking of that dinner table soon, I mean... Basically, if I remember correctly, what happens, like, they split the characters off so they can have more powerful conversations.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how to do it. Get the actors away from each other once the whole thing's come about. And, like, the stuff, the acting between Rachel Weisz and Scarlett Johansson's character that becomes really important is actually done as a flashback.
Yeah.
And so you basically...
I like that as well. I like the heist.
Well, and
spy caper.
But then,
you know,
everybody gets their time. You know what I mean? And it's not tripping over each other. It doesn't take up any big plot points. Even the biggest one I was worried about was the Red Guardian, because he's supposed to be kind of the jokey character.
Mm.
But you've got to get him to some point of catharsis. You know, it has to be to a point where he understands that he really was this girl's father, even if he didn't believe he was. Right. And that happens.
And they sell it. Like, David Harbour, as funny as he is, as silly as he is, like, he sells it. And you feel like he feels it.
I would have given him this off of Stranger Things, because he does fake dad really well. Fake dad really well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just very interesting on that end. I think that the acting is not over the top with each other, and that's why it works, you know? Query whether some of that would have worked in the Avengers. Like, that's the only problem you have in parts of the Avengers is everybody only gets 10 seconds.
Right. So, it is a little bit crowded.
I don't know. It's interesting because I'm thinking of the only Avengers where they did that and it didn't work was Age of Ultron. Because Age of Ultron is where you get the pairing. So Scarlett Johansson and I'm going to say Bruce Banner because I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have Black Widow with you know, Hulk and there's a couple other team-ups.
The whole thing is
to, like, get the meat and bones of, like, what are these people about, and it just doesn't work. It bores you. You're like, eh.
Yeah, I think probably because it was rushed, but yeah, completely.
Ed's giving me that face, like, stop beating Josh
Whedon. No!
Don't beat up Josh.
Hey, like, I've always been a big fan, but, like, recently, holy shit, does it look like he was actually a bit of a prick.
Yeah, like, this, we need to get some of our on. See, this is the thing. This is when we call, because I'm a little gossip is what I am, and this is when we call our people that we know work crew on some of these sets, and that's when we ask them, like, was he really
he like?
And the worst part is, I would say 9 times out of 10, they're like, absolutely, yeah, he's such a jerk. And you're like, no.
Yeah, it's like James Cameron, when I heard what he was like, I was like, oh.
Well, no, you remember, so I think Bryan Singer, I heard it from 3 different people in the industry. Like, one we know mutually and 2 others. And every single time it was like, he is such a mean guy. Wow. And it was like, and really rude to his people on set.
Yeah.
We don't get that. So if that's you ever so want to work with us, by the way, you know, maybe it's because we're indie and we don't have money yet. But, you know, we just generally don't try to run our sets like that because it's supposed to be fun.
What's the point? You know,
like, trust me, man, I got a job that, I don't hate my job, you know that. But in the same sense, I got a hard, like, serious, like, not fun job. Shit. Like, we're going to make a film, man. Let's have some fun. Hell, you know, like, I don't know.
I did want to kind of mention the director because we haven't mentioned her at all.
No,
we're all over the directors.
I just don't know much about her.
I don't either. Kate Shortland. She's Australian.
Okay.
She's been around since like the early 2000s.
Kate Shortland. She not the one who did Baby Teeth.
No.
What are some of the stuff that she's
done?
She
did, her first film was Somersault in 2004.
Okay.
Then her next film is 2012 where she does Law.
Okay.
And then 2017, Berlin Syndrome.
Was that an episode or a full thing?
No, those are full films. She's also done like TV and stuff, Devil's Playground.
So what is she working on recently?
Like, honestly, Berlin Syndrome 2017 was the last film that she did. Black Widow was
that
the next one.
So interesting. I'm sorry, folks, because we really should have researched that. We're going to figure out how they picked her. Because this is the other reason we love the MCU. They always pick indie directors. They pick...
Yeah, they will take risks.
Yeah, it's not even taking risks anymore. They just find the diamonds in the rough. Yeah. Like, because there are a million of us, you know, that do this.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, like, her early films, and she was very clearly, you know, a lot of awards.
Okay.
And nominations and stuff like that. But she hasn't done a lot. And honestly, it's kind of cool.
Blew it away. Yeah, just absolutely blew it. And it just is, you know, the last time we were talking about this, one of the cool things we did over the summer, wasn't too long ago, it was a couple weeks ago, is Ed, myself, and our friend Nico went to see my favorite MCU film, Wakanda Forever. We saw Black Panther. And I was telling Nico all about Ryan Coogler because I fell in love with the guy because of this and Fruitvale Station.
Yeah.
But that's really the progression. Like, he's done a couple things in between, but not much.
I mean, Creed happened after Black Panther, didn't it?
I think so. If not, it was like Fruitvale Station opens him up to Creed and to Black Panther. And it's just like, and the thing that I loved about this guy is not like, the, you know, some people think I get starstruck, and it's not really that. It's like, I listen to the interviews with these people.
Mm.
And when you listen to Ryan Coogler's interview, he's like us. Like, he's just a film nerd.
Yeah.
And I mean, he did 6 months in West Africa just so he could get the whole story right. Mm. He wrote, you know, how many Black Panther comics? Like, this guy was just so humble to be there. Mm. And maybe that's why they picked these guys.
Maybe.
But it just, it really impressed me because I was like, you know, it's not a guy that, like, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a really assy director. I want to say like a Taika Waititi, but even Taika is just an artist. Like, he's not, I never find that guy overtly boastful. I just think he's more of a, I don't care what you think of me because I'm an artist.
Yeah, I'm doing my thing.
I'm doing my thing, which those are the best, unfortunately. If we all could be that good, then we'd all be Taika.
But yeah, like, Kate Shortland, like, knocked it out of the park.
To you. I will be looking for anything else you do.
Let's watch her old
stuff. We're gonna go back to Somersault and see what that was all about. Sure. That was 2004, you said?
Yeah.
Wow, mate. Like, that's just really cool. Yeah. I just really think that that's awesome to hear. And cheers to you, Kate. You made an absolutely superb film. I hope you get, like, tons of stuff off the back of this. So, okay.
So, do we talk money? Do we talk?
I will talk. Yeah, I will talk a little bit money because we are getting towards the end. Yeah, Ed's wanting to wrap this up.
No, it's just more because I'm looking at the numbers and I gotta say it's pretty good, but
it's good for the time. Yeah, exactly. So you know what do the numbers say on there?
So it says it costs $200 million.
Yeah, that's about right for it.
Yeah, and they recoup $263 million on opening week.
Okay.
And that was just from theaters, and then $60 million from Disney Plus.
Okay. Now that $263 million, I would just say, and I'm looking at this on Wikipedia, guys, that's not what I had read from Variety.
Okay.
Variety said it's opening week, it got $90 million.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's overall. Maybe that's like
million, or... 260 million worldwide. Because what happened, and this is why Ed wanted me to bring it up, because it was an interesting article I read. So, basically, we'll start from the end and work our way backwards. Like, the article itself on Variety talks about that there are a number of theater owners. So these are the agent; these are the companies that own, like, AMC and all that are very upset with Disney because they feel that putting this on Disney Plus killed the second week and basically the further weeks of profit that they could have made. Because this is now losing to Space Jam in the movie theaters.
Ryan Coogler produced Space Jam, by the way.
Did he? Yeah. Oh, another film I'm going to have to see. I've got Fast and the Furious this week. So.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Jason's on a Fast and the Furious.
You guys all laugh. I love those films. I love them. They're just easy films, guys. They're really easy to watch. Like,
you're on, what, Tokyo Drift? Right
yeah,
now?
Tokyo Drift. I'll get up to 9 before. I have all. I still
it's
have,
so much.
That'll really be the 10th one for me because I have the other one, the Hobbs and Jason Statham one.
Yeah.
So, but this is the problem. Like, if you like action films, and I love action films, these are easy. Like, you never have to worry about them being crap.
Yeah,
like, they're going to be decent. You know what I mean? Like they were in the 80s.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, in the 80s, you should be able to pick up an action film and be like, oh, that's okay.
Absolutely.
So the problem they voiced was you should have never put this on Disney Plus. And the figures kind of showed that. So, in the first week, obviously it makes $90 million, but there's a very sharp drop off after that. And there, you know, what the argument from the theater owners is, everybody went that was gonna go in the first one, but because the other people could just sit at home and watch it, no one else was ever gonna come on weeks 2, 3, 4, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And for them, that's big money. Because again, what happens is the profits stay with Disney then, because Disney's had it on Disney Plus. Now, I was asking Ed how he felt about that, because on my mind, I'm actually kind of conflicted, because I'm like, well, Disney is the distributor, though, and it is their film.
Mm.
So the problem you would have is, like, what right does the theater people have to say, you're not helping us out? Like, they get a share of anything that shows there. Now, the counter that, and I don't know if I'm telling too much here, Ed, but Ed, I found out that to show this film, you had to book out all your movie theaters for a long time. And, I mean, this shows in Cineworld. Cineworld has, like, how many screens dedicated to this throughout the day? Yeah. So Disney is incredibly demanding as to what they want to be shown on screen. Now, that's where I was like, well, that's not fair then. If you go to a theater producer, a theater, you know, theater owner, and you say, You have to show this many times in this many places because we need the exposure. You can't then turn around and say, but we're not going to give you the profits. Yeah. Right. There should have been, and this is just my way of trying. In my day job, I'm like a mediator. That's not what I do, but I act that way. I help solve some really complicated problems worldwide. And I usually do it with this voice being like, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
What I would have done, you know, is just done sort of profit sharing deal off that just for this one because I know why Disney are doing this. We know why Disney are doing this because a million people aren't going to go in the movie theaters right now because of COVID.
Yeah.
Like, they're just being sensible.
Yeah.
And they want, you know, they promised Scarlett Johansson. They want to give Scarlett Johansson the biggest possible venue to get this out here. They have obligations as well.
Completely.
But, you know, that's what I'm saying. Just for this one, maybe cut them 10%. Maybe cut them 15%.
The problem, I guess, is the precedent that sets, right?
Exactly. But again, like, that's what I mean. Like, sometimes you have to think of novel solutions that might be repeated down the line. But I just, you know, you don't want this war. You don't want this war between theater operators and streamers saying...
And it's
because the distributors are going to win, and then theaters are going to die. And that's the thing. Like, I'm sorry. I'm still a cinema guy. I love going... once a week and watching my big screen. I got in the habit of doing it like 2 or 3 years ago and I did it all the time as a kid and I just say, like, you know, for those of us that love it, it's amazing. Like, you know?
Anyway, I won't talk about it here, but going to the theater and seeing something on the big screen, like, that was my one big regret. Watching this on Disney Plus, fine, I was at home, I was comfortable, I could pause it when I wanted to go to the bathroom.
I did offer.
No, I know.
Just so you guys don't think I'm an asshole.
No, completely. And you did say, look, I'm going...
I'm always worried I'm an asshole, because I am one, but...
but I was concerned about COVID, and I put myself in that category of where a lot of people are. So I understand Disney's point of view.
You know, and don't get me wrong, like, I've just done it before. So I was in the theaters when we were, like, in this in-between phase where people didn't have to wear masks and whatnot. And at this particular showing, the 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, there were 20, I call them kids, I hate this. I just did this to a guy at my work today. Like, he's not a kid, he's 20. But I'm old, you know what I mean? And so I had 20...
We're getting older, so we feel
I had 20, justified. 20 kids in there, and that's fine. Like, that's what I would have been doing on a Sunday night if there was nothing else to do.
Yeah.
No masks, though. I think one of them was like... One of them saw me, because I was looking at him, because I always glare at him. That's what the old men do. You know, I glared at one of them, because he was vaping. And I was like, come on, man. But then he just moved seats and started vaping in the corner. I was like, well, again, this is what I would have done at 20 years old. I would have been like, screw you, I'm going to go vape over here. And Ed knows this, because Ed knew me in my 20s. And that would have exactly... I would have been like, screw you, I'm going to go vape over here. But... none of my masks. They talk through most of the film. That's how you can always tell if the film's good or not. That's another reason I do that, because let me tell you, shitty horror films, you never get these kids to shut up. Like, whole time they'll be checking their phones. It drives me mental. It's why I stopped seeing horror movies in the big theater because, you know, I told you Hereditary was the worst example of that, because you have this really serious ending that my particular audience just didn't vibe with it. They laughed the entire ending, and it ruined it. Absolutely ruined the vibe. So that's what I mean. I get that everybody doesn't want to be thrown into that, especially now, because, you know, in our country, in our country, the UK, like, cases are on the rise. Yeah. Like, our government doesn't seem to think there's much of a problem, but, you know, we are very much in disagreement with that, you know, without wanting to be disrespectful, because, you know, we know there are no right answers anymore. It's just, I think...
Plenty of wrong ones.
Though. Exactly. We would have kept safety measures in place a little bit longer, you know? So that's where things are at. You can watch it on Disney Plus for $20, or you can just wait. The other thing is, you can just wait till this comes
on
the stream.
Wait till it comes
on. And that won't take that long. No. You know what I mean? Like, Raya the Dragon was 3 months.
Very quick.
So, which is good, by the way. If you have a kid, watch Raya the Dragon. It's really cute.
Yeah, it's a great film. I love Aquafina.
The best part is that everyone at school thought Catherine was Raya, like that character.
Ah, that's so cool.
And I was like, yeah, she is a bit like that, isn't she? She's a bit all over the place like that, isn't she?
Oh, that's so cool. But yeah, I mean, honestly, this is a film that I didn't have high hopes for, and I was worried about podcasting about it, if I'm quite honest. But, oh my God. And I think we need to give a shout out to the writers. Jack Schaefer and Ned Benson. Just having a quick look to see, okay, Captain Marvel, Olaf's Frozen Adventure.
Yeah, Captain Marvel, I guess it'd be the one that'd be most popular.
And it is one of them was the showrunner for WandaVision. Oh, that's interesting.
It is interesting that it's two male writers on this as well.
Yes.
Because this is part of the thing. I'm currently writing a feature at the moment, which I'm desperate to get done before the end of summer so we can shoot it. But I have an entire segment that's going to be like female driven, and I'm really nervous about it because I feel like I can write it. But man, the backlash you get when they're like, it's the wrong perspective.
Yeah.
So obviously that it's section will be circulating around my female writer friends being like, guys, help me here if I'm missing something big. But that's interesting. I mean, they did get a female director.
Yeah, and I think that probably made a huge difference. Also, I was listening to Robert Downey Jr. talk about like how these things work, and Scarlett Johansson 100%.
The way got, you just like, said that just sounded like you went to brunch with him. He was just sitting me down and telling me how these things work. Yeah,
me and Bob Downey.
Yeah, anyways, I'm sorry.
He was talking to Joe Rogan on his podcast. Whatever.
So it could have been you. Yeah.
Yeah. But he was saying that, you know, they will consult you. So they consulted Scarlett Johansson for sure on this one, and I think that was probably a very good move. And also, yeah, Kate Shortland must have had like some input. If not, these two men are geniuses.
This is the thing, man. I mean, this is what I love about the MCU kind of gravy train, though, is because as much as you may want to say like, oh, it's Disney or oh, it's big budget, like they are using a really good formula here. Mm. Like it's. There's not, you have taken certain actors and actresses and made them into stars. And there's not just a, you know, Robert Downey Jr. obviously is the easiest example of the long-term commitment they expect, but how it pans out. And I just, all I would say is because I'm fascinated by this. Yeah. Obviously, you that listen to, this is episode 86, like, this is the business I want to be in. I'm fascinated by how it runs. But compare with this with how the Harry Potter actors were treated. Mm. And even before that, when you talk about like Lord of the Rings, some of those franchises, like, those were done well, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But not as well as this, because those, you know, you just have to listen to the commentary from like Daniel Radcliffe. They were taken care of, but it was not like, this is it basically...
puppeteering.
Yes. And at the end of the day, like Daniel and Emma Watson and everyone else is kind of dropped in. Sorry, Rupert.
Grint.
Sorry, I do want to mention you because I think you're a cool guy.
Yeah, he is.
You know, but they're kind of dropped on their ass after this.
A little bit, yeah.
Whereas MCU has had a different mentality because they understand like the business behind stardom. Like you can't make a character, expect that from them, and not give them somewhere to grow. Mm. And the MCU gives them that place to grow because then they become a character in a universe. So they can choose to go on to other things, which is what they told Robert Downey Jr. to do. Not MCU, but other people said, Robert, go on to other things. And he said, no, I'm stuck in this one for the whole thing. And that's what, you know what I mean? It makes...
I mean, it's so cool, man. And I, again, I know we harp on about him a lot whenever we do like an MCU thing, but it just feels like Kevin Feige has like found the magical chord, you know?
No, I agree. And the only thing I add to that, obviously what I said last time, is I'm pretty sure he is always backed up though by Luis Esposito and Victoria Alonso.
Right.
Because I always see their names. I've heard, Victoria's actually done a couple of interviews on thank you for doing them, by the way, on Variety, which I mean incessantly now. You know, just to give you that kind of...
That's cool.
I think he's the lead. I definitely think he's...
His vision.
It's his vision, but
executing it.
And I'm only saying that because there's a whole army of people, this is what happens. Like, I'm finding this where, as I said, we're getting ready to start making a feature, and you need people. Like, you need loads of people.
An army. And imagine a franchise with this scope over this many years where you're trying to connect this and that. And
I mean, I just shit my pants a little bit just thinking about it. Like, oh my God, how scary that is.
I will say he probably, like, had in the back of his mind the big picture thing, but it probably grew into it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, we talked about that, right? Yeah. Like, he just, you know, it's the kind of thing, like, I do get asked sometimes, not enough times, because I really wanted to ask somebody that can do something about it, but I get asked, like, what would you do if someone just handed you an MCU film? Mm. Like, isn't that terrifying? And, like, the whole thing is, when it comes to any type of project management, you just have to have a goal in mind, and all you do is aim for that goal.
Mm-hmm.
So I am hopeful, and I've heard, you know, James Gunn talks about this, the Russo brothers talks about this. When you get on a set that big, you just have to rely on the people around you, because you're not going to be able to do everything. So that's, you know, if I'm giving messages from the producer end of things, it's learn to do that. Yeah. Learn to do it in the indie style.
Teamwork.
You know, as you move, the quicker you can learn. It's not, teamwork is a better word, because sometimes it's called delegation.
Mm.
And as I said, in my day job, I'm a project manager, and like, you don't delegate necessarily like that. Like, you have to make sure that you are engaging with people and not just handing things off to them. It's the number one mistake made, you know, that I see, that you hand something to someone and you don't know what they're going to come back with. Right. Like, don't do that. That's the director's job and the producer's job is to know what's going on set. That being said, like, get your heads a department. You know what I mean? Don't if you don't want to drill down to the detail and stuff with that, like, make sure you can trust your heads to do it for you.
Yeah.
But you've got to learn to work with it, because you'll never swim through the mountain of work that you have to do to get these films made. As I said, always watch the end credit scene. Speaking of which, what did you think of this one? We'll end on that one.
Okay.
Unless you want to say more about production stuff.
What did you think of
that final end credit scene?
It was funny. I know you're not her biggest fan. Because
it's Julie Dreyfus,
Julia Louise Dreyfus.
Yeah. I think she's warming. I'm warming to her in this.
Okay.
Because I like, she's very spunky in this, and which is kind of the character she's always played. And this one, I can see it.
But I was a little bit confused. Now, immediately after I'd seen it, because it's just in case you haven't seen it, you've watched the film, and you're like, oh shit, I forgot to watch it. But it's that. Florence Pugh's character, Yelena, is at Natasha Romanoff's gravestone because she died in Endgame, right?
And I think that's the only the second time you've ever seen the gravestone. You've seen it once in Endgame.
Okay.
And I'm not even sure you saw it in Endgame or not.
I can't remember. I don't think so.
But it's really interesting. Mm. Yeah.
And suddenly you hear someone blowing their nose, and it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's playing this character of Val, who we first saw in Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Helping out the second Captain America.
Yes, the US agent.
Yes.
But immediately my thought went to, hold on, this was supposed to come out before Falcon and the Winter Soldier. So was this going to be her first introduction, and then she shows up in
it
Falcon
could have
and
been.
The,
that is definitely
Soldier.
One of your geek room, and I call it geek room because these are the things that will be talked about on message boards. It's possible.
Mm.
It's very possible because this got moved forward.
It just felt a little odd, you know.
Did it to you?
Yeah. But I liked it. Then it kind of leads into what's going to happen to the Yelena character, where she's going to get sent after.
As I said, someone I had thought this was the Yelena from, and maybe I'm getting this completely wrong, but the Yelena from the Spider-Man game. Mm-hmm. She plays this like head of this task force. They're like a, you know, like the I can't remember the name of the desert police that everyone hated, the ops group that was hired basically to shoot people.
Was it the Thunderbolts?
No, it's a real group. Oh, you know, Bush and all these people had them out in the Middle East, like in Iraq and whatnot, like, as private military.
Okay.
And they have like, it's Black something, and I can't remember now.
Blackwater,
yeah. That was it. And it's like, it's just not, you know. Right. So she plays like a head of like a Blackwater.
Yeah.
And they're,
I mean,
they get in trouble
could be
in Manhattan.
The same character because she's like an assassin. Right?
Well, she had a Russian accent.
Right,
you know what I mean?
100%,
it must be. And it was, I can't remember though. Now that you said it's Yelena, I was like, I thought it was Elena, so maybe I've got it wrong. But it was interesting because it's taking, I would love to see that character do more in the next phase of the MCU. You know what I mean? And I think they're setting it up for that, hopefully.
Completely. What a great like handing over of the torch. I felt.
Well, and it sets it up for a really good story, because obviously Yelena's going to have the idea that Clint killed her sister, which is not true.
Right.
Like, Clint did nothing of the sort. He was tricked.
He tried to
stop her from killing herself, and she was just like, it has to be done.
So,
you know?
Do you think she's going to appear in the Hawkeye show?
I don't... Ooh. Is that... That's supposed to be like a one-off, too, isn't it?
As in just one season or
something.
Yeah, I
thought
maybe.
That's how it was, because it's him and his daughter in that.
Yeah, who's going to be played by Hayley Stanfield.
I love that story, because that's, you know, I'm a family man, right. So, you know what I mean? It reminds
You're in the bag for that.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Ed got to hang out all today with the family, and you got to see, like, it's just, you know, it's the joys that fathers have.
But the thing that I was kind of interested in was this Thunderbolts project that they're also putting together, which I think is going to be the MCU's version of the Suicide Squad.
Okay.
Like, bad guys being put together into a team and run by William Hurt's Thunderbolt Ross.
Okay.
Who appears in this one. He's the general who's hunting.
Yeah, we've seen him a bunch of times. I mean, he does look, you know... Is William Hurt really in a bad state right now? Or is that just for the show?
I'm not too sure, because...
Because he didn't even look that healthy on screen.
No. Yeah. It looked like he had a heart attack or something like that. But it's funny because we saw him in Mythic Quest as well, right? Where he played the...
That's right. He was a dying man in that too. Yeah, like, can someone, like, if anyone's listening and wants to put it in the comments, tell us what's going on with William Hurt. Is he really dying? Like,
yeah.
Sorry, after Chadwick Boseman just kind of passed without telling anyone he had bowel cancer, it was like, wow.
But going back to one thing that you were saying about, like, the commitment of these actors, these characters and stuff like that, love it. Like, What If is coming out soon, which is the alternate kind of...
Yeah, that'll just be fun, guys. Like, that's basically every episode that they do in any sitcom where they change the game on it. They're gonna make things how it would have happened if we would have done it this way. It was one of the greatest... I don't know if it still runs in Marvel or not, but
when I
read it, you know, Marvel Comics Presents, and then that was two of my favorites.
And Downey Jr.'s come back to voice Iron Man for that, you know? Like, which is so cool. Like...
Very cool.
You know? So, just everything... Like, I understand some people just don't like the idea of big franchise films and stuff like that. But I think, honestly, objectively...
No, but I'm one of those people, aren't I?
Like, yeah, you were, because certainly.
Yeah, and I still am to a degree. I mean, I will...
I mean, you are watching The Fast and the Furious.
That's right. Okay, maybe I'm not. But I'm just talking, like, my qualms with, like, Star Wars as a franchise. Because that's another big franchise owned by the same company. And I have completely different feelings about that. Because I always feel like I'm being milked with Star Wars.
Yes.
And Ed knows this because I complain 100%. Every time. I still go to see it.
And I love Star Wars. I've always loved Star Wars, right? But I feel the same as you. I feel like I'm being used as a cash machine.
Right. Because there's not the consistency there. Like, Mandalorian was amazing to me. Bad Batch was good, but... Again, like what we had since then, you know what I mean? And it's like the movies.
I think they're ramping up to do some better stuff. Hopefully, now that Filoni is
that's what I mean. They just need to fill it out a bit more because as it stands now, I've got, you know, that beautiful box set for the Star Wars Skywalker saga. But it annoyed me because I was like, God, I remember I've got to
slog through these. I've got
a lot of these films I don't actually like. You know what I mean? Like, was like, oh God, how did they manage to take more than $100 off me off that?
These films have just been getting better and better and better. And you know, honestly, still to this day, Iron Man 1 is one of my favorite films.
Well, and I guess that's the difference. And the other thing it gives me that I like, or it gives people that work in that, and it doesn't give me anything, but what it gives people that work in it, like, the MCU is almost like the comic books now, where it's an ongoing feast. Yeah. And so that's where I really see the merit there, because you've created a large franchise where you have a lot of different options. Yeah. I think it's, you know, hopefully this is what happens with Star Wars, because my qualms with Star Wars as a franchise is always that, you know, there's nowhere to go with this. Yeah. Like, you write yourself into all these corners because it's so based on these historical events that have happened and these historical characters, whereas the MCU is big. You know, so it has more than one timeline, it has more than one function, it does What Ifs. Like,
although, again, like, referencing this Robert Downey Jr. interview that I was listening to, he was like, the genius of Kevin Feige and the Russo brothers and all of these Marvel people is they love writing themselves into a corner because it makes the juices flow and creativity stuff. Like, I thought that was really,
you
really
only
interesting.
You write yourself in a corner to write yourself out.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
And I think that's what does make the great writers.
But it's the purpose. It's like, the MCU feels like it has purpose, like it's going somewhere.
That's what I mean. I mean, whenever, you know, and I used to talk with Katie Bonham about this all the time, like, whenever we're talking about, like, fundamentals of writing, like, how do I write a script, Jason? And it's not like I've written a million of them to know, but I do understand the concept quite well. You've got to go from point A to point B. And when you talk about writing into corners, that's going to happen. So when you're going from point A to point B, you might get to this middle point where you're like, oh crud. And that's when you write yourself out of it. Now, the other thing you're going to do is after you've written from A to B, then you go back through the whole thing again and make sure it works.
Yeah.
But you have to start with that initial process and you have to connect the dots. Many writers, the mistake that they make is it doesn't flow. I was taught that through business writing, that if I write anything, because I used to have to write these 5-10 page reports to insurers, and like, I had to make sure it all connected so someone's actually going to read all this different stuff. And that comes from bookending things, making sure when you go from point A to point B that you've left the crumb trail along the way so that people understand it. You know, you saw that workshop book I have that talks about like doing it like a crossword puzzle. So that's what I mean. I think the MCU just always does that better than a lot of other franchises I've seen. And I won't keep throwing Star Wars under the bus. Like, you know what I mean? Because it's not a bad franchise. It's just that's the one that always gets me because I feel like
they're doing
it a shortcut too much.
Like, the MCU are doing it the right way, if there is a right way, and Star Wars seem to not be doing it the right way.
They may be. If all these new shows come out and they've expanded out the universe, and then you can make Star Wars about a bunch of different things, then fine.
But I don't think anyone can argue that Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker, and maybe even The Force Awakens, because I know I'm an apologist for it, but a lot of people didn't like it. They had no, like, guidance. There was no, like, through line.
Right. And
you can never say that about any MCU.
Compare that to the space franchise. In Star Trek, you never really have a Star Trek. You're not... You don't know what's going on. You know what I mean? You don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, it's heady and it's, you know, very philosophical and stuff like that. But yeah, like...
They're always good at explaining who the good guys are and who the bad guys are and what's going to happen through it.
And not just that, because Star Wars does a lot of that. Star Wars does a lot of black and white.
No, it does, but that's what I'm saying. Like, I guess the difference in Star Trek to me, and as you can tell, I do like Star Trek better than Star Wars. I have a lot of Star Trek stuff. But there's just more worlds there. It's like it's more perspectives. Maybe that's the problem. Is we're talking about MCU is expanding its perspectives. Completely. Black Widow certainly does that. Yeah. And takes you into this female perspective.
How great is that? Because, like, we've had this character in the MCU for ages, and yet now we're getting to see that kind of perspective from that point of view. It's just brilliant.
It makes me very hopeful for, like the Ten Rings stuff that's coming out.
Yeah, Shang-Chi.
Because at first I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this, man. Like,
right. Are we getting into the, like, too woke for school kind of...
Maybe. I'm careful about saying that, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's more, is it a tale that needs to be told, or is it a tale that's going to be interesting if it's told? And that's the biggest thing for me. Is it an interesting story?
Again, we're going back to Star Wars just because, whatever. But, like, do you remember the kiss between two female characters in...
And that's what I mean. Like, that's the two woke stuff that we're talking about. Yeah, this stuff that feels that style like over
in,
substance.
Yeah, it's thrown in for no particular reason. And yet... Like, here, I mean, I don't think they really kind of touched on sexuality or anything like that, but there's no pussyfooting around, like, you know, when she talks about the hysterectomy and...
Right, they're not afraid to kind of say...
The great...
But even Winter Soldier was like that, you know, Falcon and Winter Soldier, that was the great thing about that show, is it tackled some really heavy stuff.
And you can do that. You can do that with this popcorn stuff.
12A, you know, it's like, listen, your kid can come to this, but we want you to be entertained too. And that's the problem I always have with some, you know, Star Wars, again, is like, you know, it's the, like you said, it's like, it has to be for the kids. And it's like, well, no, there are many more people that watch this now than kids. Yeah, it's a 30-year-old franchise.
Don't put yourself in 40-year-old in that franchise. Corner, like you say.
50-year-old franchise, Jesus. 40-year-old
Yeah. But this film does...
It sets
a lot
up
of things... But while still giving you a fun-filled action film, you know? Oh, I was going to say, the final confrontation, when he's telling her about his army of Black Widows, and you just see the pictures of all the girls coming up on the screen, and they make up a map of the world.
And that's what I was talking about. That's the scene with him, right? And it's all about, these women are so disposable to me.
Yeah.
I could care less what happens to them.
It's powerful. Powerful stuff.
And it's just, that is the male dominance in those situations. It's horrible. It's, I mean, as I said, not personal experience, but family experience. Like, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It puts you in
And I don't know, like, for me, I'm writing certain aspects about this, about a family member, and it's like, how do you get that on screen? And so when I saw that, like, yes, you have to expose to people how vulnerable the whole situation is. That, like, it's not as simple. Like, this goes on perpetually for long periods of time with no one knowing and no one understanding. That's why it worked. They were sleeper cells, right? So how have you been doing this? And I loved, because this is the comeback that you have to, like, empower women with, when she's like, but you're nothing. No one knows who you are. No one cares. Because when women get strong enough to walk out that door, like, that's the message. It's like, remember, the guy that does this to you is nothing. Scum. Yeah, like, he's not worth your time. He's not worth anything.
Actually, you know what? Well done. You've completely... like, reverse my thinking.
Oh, well, if I wasn't writing something, like, after what I'm writing for our feature, I've promised that family member that that's the next thing I'm going to write. So she's working with me now on it.
No, but you've definitely, like, changed my thinking on the Ray Winston character. I think when I do watch it again, which I'm
fully with
will.
You that they should have had him in more if they could have. Yeah. I just, that was a 2.5 hour movie that didn't feel 2.5 hours. Like, they clearly had to cut another half hour out of that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it sucks. But, you know, maybe they'll do a director's cut someday or do the deleted scenes for you. You see the So yeah,
did you? Let me ask you this because I didn't ask earlier, but there's a little bit of a twist with the family scene where they have the big fight, then they split off, and then the Rachel Weisz character says, "I called the Red Room as soon as you arrived," and there's that kind of like twist where she betrays them. Right,
the double cross with another double cross.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it was all very Rick and Morty. All of a sudden, it was.
But I loved it. I loved it.
It works every time.
I loved it.
It works every time.
Because I was genuinely like, "Oh no, you bitch!"
This is the thing. Like, okay, so because like,
she'd just done the pig thing as well. No, right?
And like that goes towards kind of my final message, because like, what would I say to indie filmmakers that love this or don't love this? What can I do to improve my craft with this? I would get this script and I would look at it. I would dissect it. I'm probably going to go do this.
Yeah.
This is a really well-written movie that has a lot of tropes.
Yeah.
And even though it has a lot of tropes, it works so well. You know what I mean? It's comedy, just at the right time. Yeah. The doubled cross and the heist movie bit right at the exact time.
Yeah.
Because everything in a good script is your timing. And so this is it, man.
Pacing was brilliant.
Pick it up and have a look at it. Yeah, because two and a half hours and you didn't sit down the whole time.
And we were talking about this when we were talking about Loki, where we were like, oh, episode 3 was just kind of a little bit slow. And then we were like, but there's only 6 episodes, so what's up? Like
why did they do it that way? Like, because 5 and 6, you know, I haven't watched it, but 5 and 6, 4 was amazing, 5 and 6 is probably equally amazing.
But it goes to the importance of pace. It's not about, like, because we're very big proponents, particularly you, of make it shorter, right?
Unless, listen, like, and I'll go further on that. Make it short unless you want to write a book. Right. Write a book. That is the medium that you can use if you want to go into exquisite detail on anything. You know,
Tolstoy level.
No, exactly. Yeah. It's what it's there for. Yeah. The film as a media, your brain, when you're watching a film, can only comprehend so much.
And concentrate for
like,
so
and I'm
much.
Not making this up. You can read a film philosophy book, which will say the same thing I'm telling you. But, you know what I mean? Like, it's just because we cannot process complicated. You know, it was in one of the books you gave me. Complicated concepts are not easy to show visually.
Mm.
So you have to keep your stuff simple or you're going to lose people.
But here, I think they cracked the, okay, it's going to be long, but we're going to keep it moving. And it's not going to feel long.
That's right. And they do that. Like, for me, it was done through the blending of good writing with really good visual. And so that's why that credit sequence is so important, because, you know, not every film needs a credit sequence. In fact, most of them shouldn't have them at all, to be honest with you, because it's too long.
Mm.
But here, you don't know the tone of this movie until you see that credit sequence, and then you are sure you know the tone of this movie, and it just moves from there. You know what I mean? So it was one of those things that visually, they take you to somewhere that the only other way to do that would have been to get Natasha into a room early on in that movie and have her do an Aaron Sorkin style explanation. Unless you're writing
Which might have been boring. Which might have slowed the movie down.
Which would have been boring. Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. Like, that's what happens with lots of dialogue. It gets boring unless you're Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For some reason, he can have people talking. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Or Quentin Tarantino.
I will add that, yes, script, yes, visuals. I think the performances also kept me very gripped in the scenes where I might have like flagged with attention.
Yeah, but that's and that's going back to Kate Shortland, because it's like how she managed to get that all grooving together. Like, it just was
getting the actors.
It's a well-oiled machine. There are so many aspects of this. I said, for an indie filmmaker though, what could you take away from this? What could you study about this if you wanted to? Take the script. Take the script and dissect it.
Script, it's pacing.
Get yourself a pen and paper. Find where the heist point is and say, this is the heist section.
Yeah.
Copy that. And if you want to make a heist film or a film that has something like that, the comedy sections especially, because this is not a film that bounds with humor, but the humor is very necessary to get across.
Just in the right spots.
It's there to get across some very difficult plot points in a very comical way. You know,
And also like connect the characters as a family, the sister dynamic again.
Right. The other thing I would highlight, like, if I was seeing, because I'm basically selling out all the things I do when I look at a script. If I have my highlighter I usually use for foreshadowing, because foreshadowing is always mirrored, right? So if you write a good script, you have something in the beginning that's going to show up at the end. There's loads of that.
Yeah,
and it's really, really, really good. So I would be highlighting like crazy in the beginning to say, this shows up, later on. The reason we do this, again, this isn't me saying, oh, I just do this because it works. It's the people have shown this. Psychologically, it's what we want. We want to see the connected picture. We want to see that kind of mirroring. So that's why it should be in your writing. Not because you're trying to use tricks to trick people, but because that's how films are made.
Yeah, completely. It's a language of its own, and it's subtle, and it's subliminal sometimes. Sometimes it's very overt, but...
I mean, if you listen to this podcast, Ed, you know... It's the kind of thing, a lot of times when we're giving you the best advice, and it's not like, you know, it's not like, as I said, we know so much
better. Our best advice.
Yeah, our best advice, right? Like, it comes from simple things.
Yeah, totally.
Love Witch, use simple lighting from the 50s if you want this. Learn it. Like, watch the videos. Watch the 60s and how they did this. Learn the lighting setups, and then you can do it too. It doesn't require a whole lot of money. It just requires time. It requires you to, you know, obviously look at things. And then it requires you... you know, to go out there and put the effort in. And I say, you know, that's the two hardest things in film. Even for us guys, like, trust me, I'm writing a script right now. It's a pain in the ass. I hate it. But I'll love it once it's done. It's just, wow, like, I wish I was so much further along right now. And then I
like the meme says, I've got to think about writing before I can get to writing.
Well, this is why a very good guy who we will have on the show at some point, who's helping us with this film, you know, kind of came to the decision and says, why don't you let Ed direct the film and then you'll do the writing and you'll do the producing, because you're the one who made this thing. But, you know, you trust Ed, don't you? And what he didn't understand when he said that is the weight that got lifted off my shoulders. Not, I want to direct. You know that. Yeah. I love directing. It just was one less thing I have to kind of try to think about.
Right.
And so, and I know Ed's solid on that. Like, I get all my directing books from Ed's house. So, and he walks me through any shot I ever want to do. So, like, that's what I mean. Like, it's just... that's the tough part about it all. You've got to push yourself through, first of all, through the doubt, because we've had lots of that already.
Yeah.
You know, and through
If you haven't listened to it, definitely do, but watch Indie Game, because that is going to tell you so much
about man, that, like, that's, the they were all just process. Like us, right? They were just like,
oh my
just God. Like we do. They'd start freaking out, because you do. You're like, you know, the worst thing was, I was telling Ed about this, and poor Becky, like, she didn't mean it this way, and she doesn't ask more than once a year because she gets this a look for it. We were sitting down, I think on Monday, outside, and I was having my breakfast, and she was like, are you going to do like a short or anything before this feature? And I was like, no, I really do have to just kind of focus on this feature now, because we want to get it done sooner rather than later, and it takes a long time, you know, to put all this stuff together. And she's like, yeah, but what have you done lately?
Oh, right.
It's like, don't say it, woman. Don't say it, because and she's such a kind, this is why we're married. Like, I immediately was like, that is what every filmmaker fears, you know? Like, I know. She goes, I'm sorry, she said, well, you did Dandelions last year, but, like, what have you done since then? And it was like, like, no, I know, I've done a trailer. I've done four trailers, like, for all my different stuff.
We've done a lot of podcasts, a lot of YouTube content. We're working, goddammit.
Exactly, like, because this is what gets you. And you're like, am I doing it right? But you just have to follow the course, because then eventually you will get yourself to a point where you could do an MCU film, because you've seen it from beginning to end. You know the process. You know that it's just a matter of willpower, really. That's the coolest thing I find about film, is it really has nothing to do with your talent, has really nothing to do with what you know at the moment, has to do with what you're willing to do. You know, what? How far are you willing to go? How many books are you willing to read about screenwriting until you get good at it? How many scripts are you going to write, you know, to get better? Is that other thing that goes back to that MythiQuest bit? You know, I always love that. Like, no, you're shit now, but you won't be because you believe in yourself.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's enough pontificating from me. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm going to hand over to Ed to close out the show, but watch this movie. It's a great movie. It tackles a topic that I think everybody should be aware of. And is, I'm so proud of the MCU for somehow segueing that into their movie. But you can learn a lot as well from the wonderful script and the way that's played around with by both, you know, Kate Shortland is an excellent director, and the main actors who do a wonderful job on this. But thank you very much from my end. Ed, what are your final thoughts?
I just want to leave you with one little tidbit, which I think speaks a lot to this film and to the performances and the level of acting that was in it. But for David Harbour, who was portraying the Red Guardian, who was kind of the funny comedic relief for a lot of it.
Yes.
He talked with Kate Shortland, the director, and they talked about performances like Ricky Gervais in The Office and Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Savages. And the idea that comedy that comes out of real domestic need. And I think that's what I loved so much about this is that nothing felt forced. The comedy didn't feel forced. The family dynamics didn't feel forced. The action, even though there is this crazy, like, skydiving segment, right?
Hmm.
It doesn't feel forced. Mm. Like, it feels natural. It feels like it has maybe, a progression.
And maybe that's a little bit about, you know, sorry, I always do that to get the last word in, isn't it? Because you just reminded me of what Wes Anderson does.
Yeah.
So Wes Anderson, and sorry, I'll really let you finish up in just a minute.
That's all right.
But Wes Anderson, he's going to take you, his comedy is that natural comedy in an unnatural circumstance. Right. That's why it works. So Isle of Dogs, Royal Tenenbaums, like these are all these really weird families, but that's why they work, because they're families. So that's why I love Life Aquatic, because, you know, it's with Steve Zissou, because the whole thing's about Owen Wilson meeting Bill Murray's character, the characters meeting each other for like the first
his
time.
His father.
And right? It's a family thing. And then I think Lily Tomlin's in that as well. It's just bizarre, but it's bizarre because the situation is bizarre, but the acting is very natural. It's very much like, you know, Bill Murray, I think, is just one of those great actors that can do that.
He really is.
Makes comedy feel completely... You know, not he's the opposite of Jim Carrey, where Jim Carrey makes everything feel bombastic and really, like, really physical. Mm. Bill Murray is just one of these low-tone kind of, this is how it is actors, you know what I mean? Which is funny, a guy that you played, you know, the crazy guy on Caddyshack, you know what I mean?
But, his later career had nothing to do with his early career. Yeah. But
sorry, that's it for me, I'll shut up now.
Yeah, go watch this movie, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Catch us on the next one. Do we know what we're doing next?
Possibly Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso if it is coming
Mitch
out next
Bain
week.
Mitch Bain will be coming on, I think, for two shows if I can talk him onto it. He's been talking to me, so.
Mitch the Magnificent.
Oh, we love him.
As I like
we
to call him.
And he had two really good choices, so I wanted to do both.
That's exciting. Okay. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. Take care.
Load up on guns and bring your friends. It's fun to lose and to pretend she's over.